a sound. Logic podcast.
Two guys with no credentials.
Reviewing Rolling Stone
500.
Greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us once again. And today we are discussing album number 4 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 greatest albums of all time list. This is Back in Black by AC/DC.
We'll get to the cover art in a little bit, but something really compels me to go and watch Spinal Tap when I see this black cover arrive.
Yeah, it's you know, it's really more of a pastel black.
Exactly. I don't know that I've ever held, I'm sure I've held a copy in person, but I don't know what the sheen is like either. It's flat black or if it... it's got some satin to it.
Is it pronounced Akadeka?
Yes.
Well, maybe we should do details because that's what we've been doing.
Yeah, so let's dive right into the details.
Okay. Don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix
don't
it.
Don't fix
right?
it. Yep. Right.
Details. So this is Back in Black, released July 25th, 1980. So. Almost 43 years ago, Ben.
Amazing.
Can believe that. I believe this was their 7th studio album. Have I got that right? 7th studio album.
That's right.
The first to have appearance of Brian Johnson. We'll talk about that in a minute. All tracks written by Angus Young, his brother Malcolm Young, who has passed now, and Brian Johnson. Charted very well. Went to only number 4 in the US, however, went to number 1 in the UK, Canada, Australia, which is where most of the band is from, and France. I think it's important to note this is their seventh album in just as many years or less. I think they they were formed in 73. I think their first album was around 73 or 74. So in that many years, yeah. And this was the first album after the unfortunate passing of Bon Scott. Bon Scott was the original lead singer. The whole band is from Australia, and Bon Scott passed away, I believe, in May of that year, if I'm getting that. I'm doing a lot of this from memory from what I've read, but acute alcohol poisoning. He kind of drank himself to death one night, went on a binge. The band decided they wanted to continue. The day after his funeral, decided to audition new lead singers. Had Brian Johnson in, I think made a decision very quickly and right away went into the studio. They said that Bon Scott might have written a little bit, and they used some of it, and I think he might have recorded some demo tracks, they've said in years since then, but really he wasn't really involved in this album at all, unfortunately. And due to his passing, then he didn't record it. So then Brian Johnson joins the band, and they click in the studio, they do the album, and... as they say, the rest is history. It's a massive hit. It goes over very well. That can be very tricky. You know, when you have a band member pass and reform, especially when it's the front man. I guess at least lead singer Angus Young obviously takes center stage for a lot of their music even back then. But they did very well and have done very well since then. Even in the last, I think in the last 5 years, with Malcolm Young getting, I believe, dementia and passing away, they have continued to, I think they're done now. Brian Johnson has had some health issues as well, and I think they're done. But yeah. Anyways, that's kind of the formation of this album and kind of how it came about. For sales, it sold an estimated 50 million copies worldwide.
That's amazing.
December Yeah, it's incredible. December 2019, the album was certified 25 times platinum in America. That's 25 million, right? So 25 million certified and then estimated another 25 in the rest of the world, making it the fourth best-selling album in the United States.
I was trying to think about like how I would have heard this. And I guess with that many people buying it, I knew someone at some point who had it and was playing it.
Yeah.
And just looking at the singles that were released from this album, like I'm guessing if our audience knows much about AC/DC, if you'd get someone to list, you know, a handful of songs, maybe five, I bet one of the songs that they list will be one of the singles from this album. Like, I think there's something that's sort of quintessentially AC/DC about this. Even though there is that pivot point from Bon Scott, it's still like, I don't know. Uh-huh. Maybe this says something about when we came along, but this is AC/DC to me, this album. And the four singles are You Shook Me All Night Long, Hell's Bells, the opener track, Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution, and Back in Black.
Yeah. Yeah, just some huge tracks. Some
huge tracks.
But before we get into the music, a couple more really quick notes here. Was produced by Robert John Mutt Lang, who I think is a pretty well-known producer. Wasn't he married to Shania Twain?
She was married to a guy named Mutt. Is that him?
I think so.
Interesting.
Yeah, she was married to Mutt Lang.
Huh.
So that's a Canadian connection.
Yeah, there you go.
I think that's about it for the kind of some of the I mean, there's lots of things around this album, but those are kind of some of the main things.
We already touched a little on the cover, but boy, it's classic and simple. It's black.
as a friend of ours might say, it's pretty slick.
Pretty slick. Yep.
It's like, you know what? We just did Beyonce self-titled couple reviews ago. Just black with her name, you know, that's it. Like, hey, if it's a good album, the music will speak for itself. You don't have to,
that's right.
You don't have to jazz it up. And I think there is something memorable about that too. I mean, I guess the epitome of that is the White Album, you know, just everybody, you know, you can, I know it's just white, but it says the Beatles on it, but you can, you know, you see that it's very iconic. I think this is the same way. I think I recognize this. I don't know why I always thought the lightning bolt between AC/DC was yellow. Maybe it is another. I think it is another albums, rather.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It follows a theme. Like I just out of curiosity, Googled black album covers. So, the aforementioned Beyonce album, got this album here. Metallica has a black album.
Yeah.
Velvet Underground has an album, ironically titled "White Light, White Heat," which is black.
Very clever.
It's a theme that lots of people have played with. Prince has a black album that's all blacked out. Kanye West has an album came out just a few years ago. Donda, I think, is how you say it.
Okay.
It's all black.
Yeah.
You got to have some confidence. To pull it off. There's a lot of albums on the list that I have never, ever heard of, and those ones don't necessarily last as long, but yeah.
I think we said when we were talking about Beyonce that, like, you can't really do that on your first album.
No.
Like, that's the album
where
you have, you know, your face or a picture of the band. Yep. You need to get your image out there, and then, you know, once you've got some gravitas, you can, you can kind of do this sort of thing. But anyways, they did it. You know, when there's this many hits and the music is this successful, I almost even wonder if the cover makes any difference at all. Like,
in some ways, I think the cliche about this style of music is like really leaning into black and leather and darkness. So I like there's something pretty rock and roll about this album cover too. Parodied quite well in the Spinal Tap movie, as we referenced earlier. But yeah, it's fitting. It doesn't strike me as like they're trying to be artistic or something. No, I think they just wanted to be bad and black. Like, and I don't, maybe a nod too to losing a band member as well, to almost pulling that funeral kind of idea too.
Maybe. I think it's appropriate now to move to the music, talk, you know, Back in Black, obviously a title track too. As I was listening to this, Ben, it wasn't right away, but I thought, hey, let's I should focus a bit more on the lyrics.
And then
I realized that
big mistake.
You know, I never, even before going and reading them, I never really cared, and I don't think I've ever listened to AC/DC for the lyrical content.
Yeah. Do they care? I guess I'm wondering that too. As I like,
I mean,
some that are like the fifth track, "Let Me Put My Love Into You," is dangerously creepy. I don't know, almost like old school kind of like sexual pressure kind of nonsense. And Shoot to Thrill too, like sort of like mixing guns and drugs and rock and roll, and I don't know, it's almost like it is really, it feels sort of cliche. And I find myself wondering, are the lyrics important, or is there just like an attitude here that they're trying to project, something that you can, you know, headbang along to and feel yourself getting pumped up? Because I like this music feels so nostalgic to me, because it fits in with the, like, I've heard Mike Myers talk about Wayne's World was, even though they said it in Chicago for the movie's sake, it was just really about growing up in kind of like small town Ontario, where your life was driving around in the car, headbanging along to your favorite song, going to the music store, not to buy a guitar, but just to like gawk at it. And then go to your house, your basement, and turn up the volume to 11, right? And then when I listen to this album, it brings me all the way back to like teenage years, to playing hockey with our buddies, or sock hockey or hall hockey, whatever hockey rendition
we were doing, hockey,
and picking out like a hype song to play as we were sort of introducing each other to ourselves, whichever teams we were on. Pick a track.
I forgot we did that.
Pick a track like Back in Black or Hell's Bells, and like everyone's gonna cheer. And it's just there's something really nostalgic about it, and I don't think it has much to do with the actual content as much as the way that they are purveying a feeling or emotion. Or I don't know. It's a long-winded way of saying all that.
I think you're right, and I think I've heard Back in Black hundreds of times. And if you asked me to sing it right now, I know the tune. I would just be mumbling all the words. I have not a clue. Not a clue.
Yeah, right.
Back in Black! That's it.
You could probably play the guitar riff.
The rest, I'd just be making
much easier than sing the song.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah, I think so. I guess the writers might have something to say about do the lyrics matter, but maybe they don't, because you know it's such a powerful sound.
There is machismo and way over the top. You know, masculine dominance, patriarchy, and so maybe there is something about. There's probably a certain slice of culture that is drawn to this for its lyrical content, that wants something kind of like arrogant and filled with swagger. But that's not what drew me to it as a teenager, or what made it cool, I guess.
No, it was it was the energy for
me. It was
me,
the energy.
The energy and the power. Yeah. The electric guitar, it's listen to the album. Like there's no ballad, you know, just all right on top the whole time. As we get into the music and talk about some of the tracks, I wanted to ask you a question. I'm going to put you on the spot here a bit. As we were prepping for this, you kind of made an offhanded comment. I don't think it was during a recording, about Back in Black, kind of like, oh, Back in Black's next, and you said, oh boy, oh brother, something like that. And so I started thinking about that. I thought, oh, that'll be interesting. And I want to hear your take on that. But I was also thinking about my reaction was, well, I was kind of looking forward to it because it's fun. But it is, you're right, it is cliche. It is kind of, you know, it is. And a little while ago, we reviewed Guns N' Roses.
Mm-hmm. Appetite for Destruction.
Appetite for Destruction.
Yep.
Okay. And I found that very obnoxious, very, again, full, like just lyrically, just very problematic, a nightmare. Even musically, like obviously amazing guitar solos and full of power, but just drove me nuts listening to it. Made me just want to cover my ears sometimes. But this has some of the same elements, yet this I don't find it obnoxious. So I'm trying to figure out why is that. So I'm wondering, Ben, after you made that comment and maybe you've had a chance to listen, do you still kind of feel that way? Is this on the same level of the Guns N' Roses, or is there something different about this?
I'm so glad you mentioned that album, because that's exactly why I said, oh boy. I thought, oh, it's going to be nostalgic for a moment, and then the second track's going to hit the same, the third track's going to hit the same.
The Guns N' Roses?
I'm going to get bored and tired of it. And it didn't do that in the same way. I don't know if it was because our friends listened to this album a bit more than GNR. I found myself enjoying it and thinking, like, this is what I thought Guns N' Roses would be, just done better. It's still cliche and the lyrics are ridiculous. And I can't quite put my finger on why I find this greater than that. This comes before Appetite for Destruction, almost a decade before. So I don't know, maybe they were pioneering this sound when Back in Black came out, but it's their seventh album, right? AC/DC sounded very similar, aside from the pretty significant change in lead vocalist. So I really can't put my finger on why I had more appreciation for this, other than maybe it was Canadian hockey rinks. AC/DC got a bit more hype up sound and play than GNR. I don't know. Are you, like, as you're asking that question to me, is there anything coming to mind for you that might explain that, why we feel that way?
I feel like if I was in front of a jury trying to explain why I like this and don't like that, other than just a personal bias that there's something, or maybe I don't like Axl Rose, or maybe I don't know.
There was way more drama around GNR in terms of, like, you know, they had that long hiatus. They worked on an album for like 10 years and never released it. Maybe AC/DC was just like someone you could appreciate without the drama in the way that GNR had. I don't know.
And
to be a debate between these two bands tonight.
I don't think it's fair to say that AC/DC was without their drama. But
no, that's true.
I think it's very different. I don't know, but there's something maybe a little that ego, and maybe part of it's Axl Rose and maybe Slash as well. It just seems so over the top, and here it's like, maybe not. I mean, the lyrics are still in your face, but maybe I don't know. I feel like I don't have a good argument. At the end of the day, I just like it more. And maybe it's more nostalgic because I did listen to it more.
Yeah.
Now I can't say if I know for sure that I ever listened to this album start to finish. I think I did.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I did. Did you? Have you? Do you know that? Have you actually?
I certainly didn't own it. I'm guessing I did. I'm guessing I did at Phil and Steve's house, brothers and former guests of the show, because I think Phil had all of AC/DC's albums and would have had it on. I do know that the final track, Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution, is probably my favorite AC/DC song. And as I think about what makes that song stand out to me, it's not as headbanging or fast-paced as the rest of the album, but it is pretty classically rhythm and blues in a way that I don't remember thinking a whole lot about when we talked through GNR. Maybe there is something about the way this music is built that feels more comfortable, familiar, in the way that I can listen to a Rolling Stones album and think, like, this is four on the floor, rock and roll. I understand this. It makes sense to me. I understand this genre. This fits. So I don't know. I'm probably... Yeah, there are songs that I don't remember at all, too. So
yeah, there was a few
hours. If I had listened to them all the way through, a couple of them really didn't stick all that well. And maybe it was the days of the CD where we'd skip ahead to our favorite tracks. I don't know.
Yeah, it could have been. And for some reason, because I haven't listened to ACD albums, I don't remember where all the hits land in terms of the different albums.
Yes, right.
And for some reason, I was like, oh, isn't Thunderstruck on this?
Right.
And Thunderstruck's on Razor's Edge, which came out a decade after this, 1990. And I didn't remember that, you know, we were still fairly young in 1990. We were 7, 8 years old. And when I heard that song, I just figured it had been around for a while, but I guess not.
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, maybe that's another thing. AC/DC is kind of, to me, kind of timeless in terms of their hits. Like, they're just kind of there, part of the zeitgeist, you know. The other thing that, you know, we were talking about charts. We didn't talk about awards because I don't think they were up for any awards. And remember, this is back in a time when AC/DC, certainly when they first came out, even when this album came out, even though it was successful, was still considered very heavy hard rock. I think even might have been considered heavy metal, and I think it was. You know, this is even before acts like Metallica, which was like that's where you're getting into thrash metal, heavy metal. You know, when we listen to AC/DC now, even the old stuff, but certainly the newer stuff, I think more people would be inclined, if you just said, what is that, what genre of rock, I think people would say it's classic rock, it's rock, it's hard rock. But I'm pretty confident there was a time when this was heavy, like very heavy.
Yep,
you know,
absolutely.
And the Bon Scott stuff, the Highway to Hell, that kind of stuff was like, you know, and the hell satanic themes, you know, was really, really, really taboo. Like, was just not, you know, you're alienating a huge part of the population, especially the American Christian evangelical population.
Sure.
Just going to steer right clear, and many of them did steer right clear of it just because of that content. So
fodder for the record burning parties.
Absolutely. And even in amidst all that, it was still so successful. There's still something. You know, so I know I'm kind of bouncing around, but you said something about blues. That's something that struck me as well when I was listening to this album. I thought, at one point I thought, what is this? You know, what kind of rock? And I thought, hey, I'm hearing a lot of blues, and not, you know, not as straightforward as, you know, Led Zeppelin is a rock band doing blues rock, you know, especially their first album. So it's like not quite out there, but I was like, there's a lot of blues elements here. Like it's it's hard rock, but there's blues here. Not your straight 12 bar blues song, but there's a lot there, and it's still, I think, a foundation of their music.
Absolutely.
Do you have any particular memories of any of this music? I've got one. I don't know if you have any.
Well, I mentioned the hockey intro songs. You know, we should maybe explain what hall hockey or sock hockey is.
Oh, man.
Phil and Steve's parents were very generous with their home. Having three boys, they let us really run wild, but we'd play hockey in their hallway, sometimes with sticks and a tennis ball. But when that got a little rough, we'd switch to sock hockey, which was basically like a duct taped sock that we'd fling with our hands down the length of the hall to try and score.
On your hands and knees, you'd flick it. You'd whack it. Yeah.
And when I press play on this album and the big gonging bell starts ringing for Hell's Bells, I thought that's definitely a song that Phil at some point like queued up as he came out into the hallway to take me on in a bout of sock hockey. So that's the one memory. You referenced our friend Victor, at least his nickname, Slick Vic. I'm sure he would have been hanging his head under the belt in the sweet corn field, asking for the volume to go up, pointing to the sky. An AC/DC track ever came on the tractor radio.
That's actually my memory is a Victor memory. It was later in the summer. It might have been our second summer.
Okay.
Picking sweet corn. If you've listened to the podcast, you know, Ben and I pick sweet corn with a lot of these guys, hand picking, walking through the fields all day. And there was a conveyor belt that swung out from the trailer being pulled behind the tractor. And it had been rigged up with speakers that were wired into the radio in the tractor. And so we'd listen to classic rock. And I remember Victor was a big, big AC/DC fan, just loved AC/DC. And it was the last day of the summer, or at least the last day before Victor went back to university. And we were on our last load, and we were picking what probably was going to be our last song we were going to finish, and Hell's Bells came on. And he just, like, you're right, popped his head under the bed, turn it up! We cranked that thing. Those poor speakers were just rattling, just all the dust shaking, and you could hardly hear it, you know, hardly hear the music, you know, just so distorted. And then it turns out we finished and we had to do another load. it wasn't even the end of the day.
It
was this huge build-up, you know, like this send-off, this, you know, just could barely even hear ourselves thinking. And that's, I think of that every time I hear Hell's Bells.
Wow. I think we probably mentioned this when we talked about our experience of going to SARS Stock or Molson Rocks for Toronto, whatever you want to call it. But AC/DC kind of stole the show from Rolling Stones, who were the final band and the headlining band, I guess you could say. They really did have, even you know, past their prime, was it 2000 and, would it have been 2002, 2003, somewhere in there? They were still really putting on a show, and I remember the crowd getting excited. We had been sort of heat stroked and in the sun all day long, and still brought everyone to their feet. Still had that energy.
Oh man! And they, not only do I really think they stole the show, but it was a magical time because they played through the sunset. So they started when the sun was hanging.
Yep.
They were there through sunset and then all through the twilight. And I think it was dark, and it was just, it was
really
cool. And
watch that again.
Oh man, it was fun. I mean, I, and I don't mean to be disrespectful and say this, I remember being ready to, like, when the Stones came on, and it was a long day. Like, we got there.
Yep.
It was smoking hot. It was, you know, it was just blazing hot. there was 500,000 people there. And if it wasn't for other people who I felt wanted to see the Stones, I was getting close to saying, like, why don't we just go, you know? It was like, the Stones were fine, but you know, maybe it's not fair to them because it was, again, we had seen like 15 bands and we were exhausted. We were sitting, we didn't have chairs. We just had some blankets on, you know, this gravelly grass that we were sitting on. You know, we were pretty far back from the stage, you know, so we were tired. The Stones were fine. Nothing wrong with their performance, you know, but AC/DC, I think, was definitely a highlight that day. They were amazing. They were so good. Huh?
Absolutely.
And you said past their prime. I don't know, man. Like, you know, I think they had just released an album maybe a year or two before. They were still just cranking.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I say that, and I got to watch what I say because I'm now following some of these bands that are in a similar age range, but I remember thinking they looked old and were still somehow pulling it off. You know, let's see, Brian Johnson was born in 1947, so 2000, you know, at the turn of the decade, he was in his 50s. So, you know, and still pulling it off, but... but definitely not like, you know, not jumping around the stage in their 20s and 30s kind of. I guess that's what I mean when I say in their prime.
Well, I remember thinking that Angus was maybe a millisecond behind on Thunderstruck, but that's pretty critical of me sitting here. I can barely even play that riff, and he probably played it a million times. Anyways,
right.
We digress. But you know, I think it's safe to say we, even though this isn't one that we own or one that we even listen to, there's a lot of memories here, and it's music that's really a big part of our culture, at least our, you know, white North American rock. I don't know if that's a thing. I know they're Australian. Four parts are Australian, one part Scottish. Brian Johnson's Scottish? He's Scottish, right? Pretty sure.
English.
He's English? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, all you... yeah, English. Sorry, I don't know why I thought he was Scottish. Anywho.
We should also say here, I think when we spoke with Barry Taylor... way back when we... What album was he even on for? Oh, he was on Sex Pistols.
Sex Pistols.
Yep. God Save the Queen. We've got a real Brit to talk about that album. He was a roadie for AC/DC, but several years before this album, he would have been part of the Bon Scott era. And so we love you, Barry, but I think you're... Your voice will be a part of another episode at some point, maybe down the road. Yeah. But this was not the one that we thought might be the prime one for it.
If I'm remembering correctly, Barry was on their crew on the Highway to Hell American.
They kind of
tour.
Broke into the United States. Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think he was with them for Back in Black, but I'm not sure. We don't want to forget. We need to pick a couple of our favorite tracks.
Oh, good
for
point. Yeah,
our Spotify playlist.
We've been off and on with that. So.
Yeah, we want to get back. We want to get back in the habit. Back in black.
Back in form.
Back in form. Do you have a favorite?
I think I mentioned Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution.
Rock and Roll. You said that's your favorite AC/DC song. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Whew. Okay. I want to give honorable mention to another, I think, early 2000s. I think it was the year 2000, cultural reference. My sister and I both watched the movie A Knight's Tale quite a lot with Heath Ledger. And I believe this is the closing track because the whole... It's a medieval knight movie, but the movie opens with the crowd at a medieval jousting tournament stomping and clapping to Queen's We Will Rock You. And that sets the stage for the movie being full of modern rock tunes.
Right.
And I think when we talked about David Bowie, Station to Station, I mentioned that I think of the scene when they dance and they do Golden Years in A Knight's Tale. So I also think about A Knight's Tale when I hear You Shook Me All Night Long, because that's a movie I watched a lot. Right. I like that song. I like, I like Back in Black a lot. And that riff is just, you know, every guitarist, every electric guitarist, it's probably one of the first riffs they want to learn.
So I do a lot of people, apparently. It has over 1 billion listens on Spotify, which is just amazing.
I think I'm going to pick Hell's Bells. There's something about it, is that classic, you know, but the way it starts is so, not just the bells, which is chilling, but the guitar. it's a special song. And yes, it's a little cliche, and yes, it's overplayed, but I love it. And and it also reminds me of the Slicksters. So
perfect.
Yeah, that's mine. So concluding thoughts there, bud.
Yeah.
What has aged well? What has not aged well? And this is almost a 43-year-old album.
Yeah.
Still played, you know, in sports events, movies, on the radio, at least on the radio I listen to, rock radio, it's on a lot. Yeah. What has aged well?
I would say it's aged in the same way a lot of things that previous generations really enjoyed. It's aged along with them. So this music, I'm guessing, would be in a car commercial. And because they want to appeal to the, you know, 50, 60, 70-year-olds who still want to rock. I'm guessing there are younger people who are also listening to this music. But they're probably listening to it as like an alternative to something else, trying to be a little different, not because this is like mainstream sounding anymore. There is no mainstream, right? Music has diversified in so many different ways. I just don't think that this, I think there was, I forget if it was the best-selling albums of the year at the end of last year, but like for the first time ever, there were no new rock albums that made that list. There were like a couple of compilations of past bands that did quite well in the year, but nothing new that was rock and roll made the best-selling albums from last year. I think it was last year or the year before. And it just made me think, like, something about what is in right now is not this. Doesn't mean that no one's listening to it anymore, and there are plenty of people who still, myself included, will turn on classic rock radio, and you mentioned it as well, as your workplace. But I think there's something, I don't know if it's stale or just not in vogue at this current moment about this style, this sound.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think the rock sound is still relevant in many places, but not every place. And certainly electronic pop music is dominating right now. I still think if you play guitar or if you like rock, the music is still very much as aged well, is very relevant. The vocal delivery, I don't know if Brian Johnson's vocal delivery was ever, quote, popular. He's so unique.
Yeah.
the lyrics have not aged well, nor do I even think they necessarily were great to begin with. But the music, I think, is still, at least in rock circles. I'm sure there's lots of other rock music from 1980 that is not relevant at all. In rock circles, this is still very much, you know, the cream of the crop.
Mm-hmm.
A benchmark to reach. I think so. It's album number 84 on the list. It's fallen... not much. It was 73 in the first, and then 74 in the coffee table book, and 77 on the next list, 2012, and now it's just dropped down another. So it's about the same spot, virtually. 84. What do you think about that placement for this very, like, fourth cellist fourth best-selling album in the U.S. ever.
Right. I would say I'm surprised it's not ahead of Appetite for Destruction. I'm not surprised that it's this far down the list based on all that we just said about what has aged well and what has not. And it will be interesting to see in another decade or two, who knows how many more Rolling Stone lists there'll be like this, but if this continues to drift downward or if there is something about just how many that it has sold that keeps it kind of afloat. There's an energy and an attitude here that I think is kind of timeless, but lyrically it's aged poorly, and it just makes me wonder, like, if this is about as high as we'll see it from here moving forward. I don't know.
Interesting.
I'm skipping ahead here just a little bit, but they did have another album. We've talked already about Highway to Hell, which came out the previous year. It was on the first three iterations of this list and fell off completely. It had been right around 200. So there's something about this style, this band, that is becoming maybe less on the tip of people's tongue when they think about the greatest albums of all time. This one is here and it's lingering, but my hunch is that it's probably in danger. Falling down a little.
Threatened.
Yeah.
Interesting points about that, about the shift. I would say this is maybe that argument between successful and influential. And I don't want to, I'm not implying that this album was not influential, but, you know, in terms of like culturally impactful or radical, bringing in, you know, new ideas or something. I know this is the number one album, but something like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, you know, that kind of brings in these really potent, relevant cultural ideas. This is not that. Musically, it's powerful, and probably new, you know, in a lot of different ways. But then the other hand, it's extremely successful, like very, very successful, one of the best. So in some ways I say, well, I could think, yeah, I'd be okay with this, you know, closer to 150 or 200. But on the other hand, I go, yeah, but it's like, you know, 50 million copies. Like, maybe it should be higher.
So I
don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I put it top 50, but something tells me I feel like this is a little low. However, I don't disagree with you that I think this would trend, at least the way I think things are going right now, would in another 10 years would continue to trend down. Yeah. And you mentioned, there were two ACD albums on this list. Now there's only one. Highway to Hell is no longer on the list. So this is the only one. If we do all of the 2020 list, this is the only one.
Yep.
That's it. Any other comments before we sign off?
No, we made it to the end of another review, and
it's
good to continue through this decade of albums.
Do you want to tell us what we're going to discuss next week, Ben?
Yeah, this is a week where we'll be revisiting an album. We haven't done that a whole lot in this block.
No, there's been a lot of new ones.
We're going to be shifting again to John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band, an album, ironically, I guess, by John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band. So we'll get to revisit that one and see if anything's changed in our thoughts, and we'll go from there.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. Thanks, Ben, for the wonderful nostalgic conversation.
That's right. Let's go play some pond hockey or something.
Yeah. I kind of want to do that now. Or at least some sock hockey. Try and knock out some more of those little windows above kitchen door in the farmhouse. Until next time, we hope you continue to be well. We hope that you take care of yourselves and those around you. And of course, we hope you join us again right here on the Sound Logic Podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our Sound Logic Podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.